If you've opened a social media app any time in the last several years, then you know that pet content reigns supreme. Videos of cats perched in wild places, or piles of puppies stepping all over each other when a treat is at stake, or unlikely animal friends napping under a blanket. We can't get enough. There's just something about the connection between people and their pets that resonates with all of us. Dr. Karen Fine has been an animal lover as long as she can remember. Veterinarian was the only career path she ever considered walking. And that path has taken her to fascinating places as a result. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Her new book lets us tag along to veterinary school, trips abroad, and clinic rotations. It also chronicles the 25 years she spent making house calls as she built her own practice. It's called The Other Family Doctor. A veterinarian explores what animals can teach us about love, life, and mortality. And she joins us now to talk about it. Dr. Fine, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want you to share a little bit about your grandfather, who was a doctor, not a vet, but a medical doctor. And I want you to tell me a little bit about his approach to medicine.
Thank you. Yeah, he was just the most wonderful kind of patient, kind doctor. And I know he treated people, my father would say, from birth to death. I didn't get to see him very often because he lived in South Africa. But I did visit occasionally, and they did come and visit as well. And he would always take my pulse, and he would hold my hand in his. And just that feeling, that connection, and that touch seemed so important in terms of his medical practice.
He visited patients at home. That was the center of his practice. What did he learn about them when he traveled where they lived?
He used to say he didn't know how he could treat patients without seeing them at home. And he would tell stories like about how he'd go to someone's house and the curtains were drawn and, you know, the sink was full of dishes. Not that, you know, my sink's not full of dishes, but maybe right. A home that used to be tidy and now was not. And he could tell if someone was depressed. And he actually developed an interest in psychiatry when it was sort of early on. And he never really was able to kind of fulfill that interest. But I think it was his going into people's houses and really talking to the people that kind of pointed him in that direction.
It's so fascinating. I remember when I was covering education as a journalist, I went to a school in Dallas once, and they said one of their big points of pride was that every single teacher in that school would visit every child at home before the beginning of the school year. And I asked why, and she said,
really?
She said, how could a teacher ever say to a kid, find a quiet place at home to read if she knows they share an apartment with 10 people, for example?
Yeah, and sometimes I'd see a home that would be very chaotic or very, you know, I just remember walking into one home and the cat was itching, and I have allergies, but they had so many sort of plug-in air fresheners that I started sneezing as soon as I walked in. Mm. So I thought, well, that might be why the animal's coughing, and they don't know. But it sort of the air freshener thing had never really occurred to me before I went into that home.
How interesting. When your grandfather died, it was decided that you were going to inherit something very special, a little treasure of his. What did you take of your grandfather with you into your own work?
I took his doctor bag, and it was just incredibly emotionally valuable to me that the family had decided that I should inherit it. And I was in my last year of veterinary school when he died, and just having this bag, and there were some of his instruments in it, it was just incredible to me. And I kept it, and I always had this thought in the back of my mind that house calls and working part-time in a practice, just like he did, would be a wonderful way to practice, to live my life. So and after a few years, I ended up trying it, and I just loved it.
What do you think sparked your deep love of animals? You were not someone who grew into this. Like, you were, as a child, you loved creatures. Where do you think that came from?
You know, I really don't know, because we didn't have any pets at home. My father loves dogs. My mother is not an animal person, and she's just not. And then she just, you know, we had my brother did have some fish when we were little, but I didn't get an animal till I was 11. But I have a plate I made in kindergarten, and they had us draw on a piece of paper, and then they sent them out and they made these sort of melamine plates out of them, which was wonderful. And I drew a girl walking a dog. And it's just so clearly that's where, it was just innate. I think I don't know why.
That's just who you are. You're wired that way.
Yes,
I love it.
absolutely.
So there's such a beautiful start to this book because you kind of chronicle this incredible adventure, this safari adventure you got to go on with relatives in South Africa. First of all, to paint a picture of what that was like, this is not like a drive-through zoo situation. This was like an incredible, intense animal viewing experience when you were, what, about like preteen? Is that kind of how old you were?
Yeah, I was 11 and it was incredible. I was with my aunt and uncle and my cousin who was 4, and we drove several hours. So I was staying with them in Johannesburg, and this was several hours away. We were in the car, and once we went through the gates of Kruger Park, you're not allowed to get out of the car unless you're in one of these camps where you stay. Or they did have a couple of rest areas where you could get out of the car, but these were all gated. And everybody had stories about someone who was eaten by a leopard, or a car was trampled by elephants. And hippos kill a lot of people, actually. You'd think they were slow moving, but I always heard stories about never get between a hippo and the water,
I will
is
definitely
what they would
take your
say.
word very seriously on
Yes,
that.
exactly. So you are, and the place is huge. It's the size of Wales. It's about the size of Rhode Island. So it's just absolutely enormous. And it's sort of like you're in the not the zoo, because the animals don't really care about you. They sort of learned long ago to just ignore cars. If you get out of your car, that's a whole different story. But the animals were unbelievable. The first thing we saw were impalas, because they are everywhere. And then, you're just driving along and you don't know what you're going to see. You might see an elephant. You might see a lion. I mean, lions were kind of rare, but we did see them. We saw a giraffe. We saw zebras. And I was a real horse-loving kid. I still love horses, but to see a zebra was just, and you just have no idea where you're going to see them. It's not like, oh, let's drive to the zebra enclosure or something like that. They're just, it's totally random. And if you see another car stopped, then you think they're likely looking at something. So that's very exciting if you see another car stopped.
You made such a beautiful point in that story that, at the zoo, animals look almost strange. I mean, you can't believe it when you look at a giraffe at the zoo, you're like, oh my gosh, look at that long neck. It's just so incredible. How strange. But when you were on this safari, it looked very natural because you were watching giraffes eat from trees as they were intended. And you kind of made the point that it was the car that was out of place and the animals seemed to fit.
Yes, that's exactly how I felt. And it was a really such a wonderful life-changing experience to have that realization that I was in their territory and I was the one out of place. And a lot of the most times where you see animals on a safari is dawn and dusk, because a lot of them are sleeping during the noon hour, that sort of thing. So hunting and everything is a lot of dawn and dusk. So just in the sort of partial light, to be seeing sort of the silhouette of a giraffe's head, and you see it through the trees and you see it reaching towards the top branches to nibble some leaves, it just seems so natural.
That's amazing. Talk to me a little bit about your training to become a veterinarian, because this is not an easy road. There's not that many places that you can go and get this education, first off, so it's difficult to get accepted.
It's very difficult to get accepted. When I was going to school, there were 26 veterinary schools in the US, and now I think there's a few more. But yeah, there's very few. There's a lot of competition to get in, so it's very difficult. And the focus for my entire childhood and young adult until I was 18 was getting into veterinary school. And then once I got in, it was very challenging. It was sort of, the step from high school to college and then college to graduate school. My niece is in law school right now, and we were talking about graduate school and how her friends who aren't in graduate school are, they can do things on the weekends. And she's saying, you know, I can't. I need to do laundry. I need to do groceries, and I need to study more because it's not like you have the weekends off. Whereas in college, college compared to high school can be more work depending on what you're studying. But vet school was a whole nother level.
And you went to vet school at Tufts, and while, of course, there were women enrolled, there was still like lingering resentment about women being trained as veterinarians, both, from colleagues and peers, but also from once you graduated, some of the practices weren't really interested in having a woman on staff.
No, and that was a real eye-opener for me because I really didn't think I have to give Tufts a lot of credit that there were some people that grumbled about it, but Tufts had never excluded women, and the people who were grumbling, it was because the class 2 years ahead of me had had some very outspoken women, some outspoken feminists who said, you know, this is not okay. And they listened and they said to some of these teachers who were kind of making sexist jokes that were inappropriate in the classroom, they said, you know, you can't do this. So we heard some grumbling by some of these teachers, which was uncomfortable. And then I was looking for a job and I called, I was using a payphone because I was out in New Mexico. And I used a payphone, and I back when they had payphones, and I called, and the vet answered the phone, and I said who I was, and I was all nervous, and I said, you know, I'm wondering if you received my resume, and he said, oh, I won't hire a woman, and I just thought I hadn't heard right or something. It was like the world stood still for me, and he said, oh no, I'm not going to hire somebody who will just have get pregnant and have kids and quit, and I was speechless. I was just absolutely, I didn't know what to say. And then I got off the phone, and you start thinking things like, well, you wouldn't want to work for such a jerk anyways. But to know that certain jobs were not available, I definitely felt that as a female, there were, you know, if he felt like that, how many other people just wouldn't hire me but wouldn't even come out and say that? And then even the legality of it for a tiny practice with a few employees, they don't fall under some of the legal guidelines saying that, you know, you can't say that kind of thing to
Right.
someone.
Oh.
So
Well, we're getting close to our first break, but tell me where did you eventually settle after graduation? Where was that first kind of professional job?
it was in Massachusetts, and oddly enough, it was in the town I live in now.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, I came back to Massachusetts where I had grown up.
What
So
did it feel
that's.
like those early days where all of a sudden you're actually practicing everything you've learned and it's you're making the decisions?
It was absolutely terrifying. So back then, there wasn't a whole lot of the word mentorship was pretty much unheard of. And now it's a much bigger deal about, especially for a new graduate, that you're going to mentor them. And that it was sort of, I was put on call my third day there. I didn't know where the light switches were. I had a pager. And I had to come back sometimes in the middle of the night. So that especially was very scary because I was usually working with another doctor there. So I had someone I could ask questions of, and I would say, oh, I'm just going to bring Fluffy out into the back. And, you know, I would feel nervous about that, but I would just ask questions.
That's a good way around it, but when you're on call, it's a bit of a one-person show, I'm assuming.
Exactly, especially in the middle of the night.
I'm wondering, how did you get from I'm working at a clinic to I'm going to do this really interesting thing where I do hybrid clinic days and house call days?
Yeah, so well, sort of fortunately slash unfortunately, my first two jobs were, sorry, that my dog just moaned as she turned over. She's asleep, but she just let out a groan, and she's very happy lying in the sun. So I had my two first jobs were not very, they just weren't very friendly to a young associate. And unfortunately, I found a lot of my classmates were in the same situation. People had moved jobs because they weren't mentored, they didn't feel comfortable, they weren't treated well by the practice owner. And in my first job, it was actually not a veterinarian, which in some states is illegal because they don't really understand. So, you can have a, something come up and they don't have that experience, that background to understand. So my first two jobs didn't go well, and I thought, maybe I should think about Opa's job and doing the house calls. And then I thought, I've got his doctor bag, and I thought, well, I'll try it for a year and see how it goes. And I got a part-time job that ended up being a pretty good job. It was for 3 days a week, and I thought, well, how many hours can you work in 3 days? Well, it turns out a lot of hours, but it was good because I was able to pay my bills pretty much and start seeing house calls. And back then, I actually took out an ad in the Yellow Pages, so this is really dating myself. And then after a few years, there was a lot of word of mouth, and I had a lot of repeat clients, and people gave my name to other people, so I stopped advertising after a few years.
That's so interesting. It's a pretty bold decision because I'm, as you kind of alluded to, if I could pay the bills pretty much, there's probably some tricky financial challenges with doing your own thing out on your own, seeing people in their homes.
Yes, there was. And we had a little bit in it's hard in vet school. There's so many potential topics. So in terms of business and finance, and we didn't get much about that. And I always found it hard to charge enough for my services. It was just, especially being in somebody's home, sitting at their kitchen table. But I tried to have a price list and stick to that, and raise it every so often. So I tried to do my best.
Makes sense. You had a really memorable, is the word I will use because it was very memorable, but this was not positive. So let's not confuse the two. You had an experience with a puppy mill that really wanted you to work with them. First of all, can you kind of describe the situation that Sandy, that's a pseudonym, I believe, created and what
Yes.
they wanted you to do?
Yeah, so I got this phone call, and it was from this woman I'll call Sandy, and I had heard of her pet store, which was in a rural town, a couple towns away from me. And she wanted me to come because the state law required them to have their puppies examined once a week. And they had had a regular veterinarian who had quit. So they were looking for somebody new. And I really didn't want to have anything to do with puppy mills. And I really also wanted the, I didn't want to have anything to do with puppy mills. I really was interested in the bond between animal and owner. I didn't want to work on something, even if I felt like it was a really not a puppy mill and a good operation somehow. I felt like I didn't, I wanted to see that bond between person and animal, not before they went to their home.
Right, because even
And
small breeders, I mean, that animal's not going to stay with them.
exactly. There are some good breeders potentially, but yeah, exactly. They might need that, but they don't need it. They're not high volume. This was sort of a high volume, basically a pet store, but it was in somebody's home. And but she quoted me this huge price, which was very tempting, but I still said no. And then she just was very insistent. And finally, I thought she really didn't have anybody else. I think she was pretty desperate, but I was not very good at saying no. And so finally I said, okay, well, I'll come once and, maybe, potentially until you get somebody else, but I'm not going to be your permanent person. So I went once. And I went into this crowded basement where cages were stacked on top of each other in these little rooms. And they were just all these puppies in cages. And they brought me puppies one by one. I sort of set up on a table in this little room. And a lot of them had this crusty yellow nasal discharge, and they were sick. And nobody knew. They had all these sort of young high school age kids working there. The owner actually wasn't there when I got there. I was sort of surprised. And some of them had ear infections, and I was recommending prescribing medication for them. And the high school kids were kept bringing them out. And at the end, I had seen 87 puppies.
Oh my gosh.
And nobody knew. This is what got me. When I'd see a sick one, Nobody knew whether they'd been eating, whether they had vomited, how long had they been sick, were they coughing? Nobody knew because there were so many of them. How could they possibly be monitored? They weren't taken outside to relieve themselves. They just sat in their cages. And, they were, hopefully they had enough food and water, but the ventilation was poor. And there were just so many sick ones. It was a very difficult experience. And then Sandy ended up calling sort of when I was almost finished. I don't know if they had called her or she had called them to see how it was going. And she was very upset that I had prescribed medication for so many puppies because then they couldn't put them up for sale the following weekend. So she was very unhappy with me, and it was a very terse phone conversation. And I could tell I wouldn't have been welcome back there even if I had wanted to go. And so I left, and I had the check that she had pre-signed, and I actually went right to the bank and cashed it, which was the only time I ever did that because I was worried she was going to call the bank and put a stop on the check. And I had been there for hours. It was a fair amount of work for 87 puppies. It
87
was a
puppies. Unbelievable.
Yes, and I keep all my records. That was very helpful in writing my memoir, I have to say, because this was a very long time ago, but I just don't throw anything away. So I was able to, count, and I knew how many puppies and what breeds. I have all my records. And I ended up writing a letter to the MSPCA and with a copy to her saying that I really recommended that they change their ventilation and some other recommendations. So I'm sure I'm on her hate list. But I just, it was very upsetting. And now when I see people and I see puppy mills, and they're online now, they're online, you can see all these different breeds. And I just kind of know what they're doing. And they're really a lot of times lying to people. Like these places will say, oh, we hate puppy mills. Our puppies are from good breeders. But reputable breeders don't sell their puppies online to anyone with a credit card. They want to make sure their puppy's going to a good home. And that's one of the main differences, I would say, between a reputable breeder who just breeds like one breed of dog and a pet store or one of these online places that, you just type in what breed you want and it comes up.
I was going to ask, just as a little news you could use section here, could you give a couple tips about red flags if you're not an experienced pet owner and you're looking to get a dog? Obviously, we know the shelter is one thing, but if someone is trying to buy a dog from what they think is a breeder, what are some things to look out for? Because I know you've had people that you saw in clinic that came in with a sick dog that they thought they had gotten from a nice kind of family farm situation, and that's not
Yes.
what it was.
No. And in fact, one woman came in and she said, "This isn't even the puppy I bought. It's a different color." And she had seen a picture online. The people were very friendly and talkative until she picks up the sick puppy that's not even the one she thought she was getting. And then she can't get hold of them. And it was just a very sad situation. Yeah, I would say don't buy a puppy online, really. I think, it's better to get one more locally from a rescue or shelter, or if it's from a breeder, make sure, for one thing, the breeder should be interviewing you and asking you questions, which is annoying. And I get that people don't like that. They'd rather click, click and not have to deal with that. But the reason they do that is because they are really concerned about their puppies, and they want to make sure they're going to a good home and they're not going to end up in a shelter. They're not going to end up euthanized because, they weren't trained or whatever. They want to make sure this is going to be a really good home for them. And a reputable breeder will also take the puppy or the adult dog back if there's ever a problem. They don't want to think of their animal kind of out there, somewhere else. So they, a lot of times, and it's just because they love their dogs. So that's, those are all kind of good things. You should be able to go there. This would be a red flag if somebody says, "Well, my house is a mess, so I'll meet you at the local supermarket or pet store in the parking lot." That would be a red flag. You should be able to go to where the puppy came from. You should be able to meet the mother, potentially the father, if they have the father. and you should be able to see where the puppy was living. So if you can't do that, that's a red flag. And there's some good resources. The Humane Society has a very good section on avoiding puppy mills. And I have that link and some others on my website in my resource section. And my website is KarenFineDVM.com.
So I want to talk a little bit about what you were just mentioning. You were primarily interested as you started practicing in the bond. You loved knowing how owners and dogs and cats and other animals work kind of in concert. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things you learned that were outside the scope of the practice of veterinary medicine. One of the stories in the book that really stuck with me was your experience caring for this huge mastiff named Athena after surgery.
Yes, that was during vet school. And so I was the student assigned to the case. I was at the hospital. So I went in to the room and there was an elderly woman, and it seemed like a mismatch that she had this enormous mastiff who was well over 100 pounds and I'm sure outweighed her. And the dog needed cruciate surgery on its leg, needed a knee ligament surgery. And she needed the dog to be boarded there because it was winter and she wouldn't be able to handle the dog on a leash outside. I think it may have had a bandage on afterwards. And so she was concerned she wouldn't be able to do it herself. So she boarded the dog. So I examined the dog and I went to talk to the doctor in charge, and the doctor in charge said, "Okay, you can take this dog out back and get her set up in a cage." And I was her student. So every day I went to Athena, and that's the mastiff's name, and I had to take her temperature, pulse, and respiration and do a full exam and write notes in her chart. This was all training us what to do. And she was always wonderful. She was in a large run. I had no problems. I didn't have to ask anyone to help me when I examined her. And then I went off that rotation a few days later. But I was still in the animal hospital, so I told her, "I'll come back and see you, but you're going to be another student's responsibility now." And then I went back to see her a day or two later, and there were giant signs taped up over the door of her run saying, "Danger, will bite, caution," all these words we use when you really, really have to be careful. And I found a technician that was working there, and I asked her because I said she never gave me a problem. And they said, "Oh yeah, she's a very, very difficult dog. No one can go near her." And I went in her run, and she was just the same with me. And I ended up being the only person who could really handle her, to the point where they had to call me off my rotation to remove her sutures when it was time to take her sutures out because nobody else could get near her. And that was very gratifying to me that, wow, this dog will only let me approach her. But at the same time, I was thinking, why would that be? Because no one's been unkind to her. No one's, everyone's been nice to her. What's special about me? And then I realized that I was in the room with the owner, and the dog trusted me because of that. She was that loyal to her owner. So what I first thought was sort of a mismatch situation, it was very clear to me the bond that they had.
That's so incredible. How often did you have to decode something like that? Try to figure out, okay, now why is this way? And kind of look into the world of trust and love and pet psychology to try to figure out why is this like this? It's because seeing a pet is different than seeing a human being because they're not communicating with you traditionally, but they do communicate with you in different ways.
In different ways. And I think psychology is really a big part of it. And fortunately, I did take a psychology class in college, but I really wish it was required as a prerequisite for veterinary school, because I took a year of physics and a year of organic chemistry. That was all required, and I never used them. But psychology, but human and animal, which a lot of times is very similar, is just so useful. I feel like I use it all the time. And a lot of veterinary medicine is decoding. So I'm decoding, the signals I'm getting from the animal. For one thing, am I safe examining this animal? I'm decoding their signals. I'm decoding what the person says as the caretaker. How accurate are their descriptions? Some people are very sort of overly concerned, and some people are maybe not as concerned as they should be. So I'm trying to evaluate that when I get the history from them and I'm looking at the animal. People that I know well and I've been in their home, and most of my clients are very, very observant. But sometimes, even observant people, the animal will get sick. And that was what led me to kind of realize and understand. It was just the practice that I would see these very sick animals and the people would say, they were fine the other day. They were fine last week. They were playing, they were eating. And now they're not feeling right. And I was be looking at this animal, realizing that whatever it, something serious had been going on did not just start, but the animals would only start showing signs when they really didn't feel good. So they kind of got to a tipping point. And that's very common with dogs and especially with cats, that they don't really show signs until they don't show signs until they're quite ill.
We talked a lot about what a big part of your job, the relationship between the pet and the pet owner was. It was so interesting. You even said half the time you felt like when people were in with their pets, they were there for themselves as well. They needed you to know something or hear a story or help them connect something they were struggling with.
Yes, and I feel that that's really why I wrote the book, because I feel that I see a lot of human suffering. And that's my dog shaking her head in her sleep. But I see a lot of human suffering. And I think part of the reason that people feel very guilty, I think, for one thing. And a lot of that is this huge responsibility of being a caretaker of someone from another species, that people maybe don't feel that they understand how to care for, or when it comes to making really serious decisions, these are very fraught decisions often. And people feel that they don't have the understanding, or they're just such important decisions and the people are so bonded. And I feel that sometimes veterinarians and clinic staff are the only people that may understand in somebody's life. It may be the only person they can talk to who understands and really gets their relationship with their animal and how important it is to them. And I'd really like that to be more accepted in our culture, that people often have these profound relationships and profound bonds with these non-human creatures. And it's such an amazing, wonderful thing. But I think people feel very alone in that. They feel that people don't understand, and maybe society doesn't understand. So that's called a disenfranchised grief, when you feel grief. And a lot of people feel grief before their animal dies. Their animal could be perfectly healthy, and they hear about another person's animal dying, and it brings them to tears. And that's quite common. And people don't understand, or they think something's wrong with them, I think, sometimes for feeling that way or feeling so attached and not knowing what to do with these feelings. So that's really the main reason I wrote the book, is to try to show people that these things are so common, and especially at the end of life, which is, our culture doesn't really deal that well with death. And if you're gonna have a cat or a dog, who are my patients, then most likely you're going to outlive them. And it's such a, it's something I deal with on a daily basis. And sometimes it's a euthanasia, and sometimes it's a quality of life conversation. And those are pretty much a daily event.
One of my favorite parts of the book was getting to know your pets. And let's just say it from the outset, you are an incredible namer of pets. I love your pet names so much. The original three that you talk about is your cat, Daiquiri, and your dogs, Trudy and Rana. Just excellent names.
Thank you.
Also memorable. But talk to me about how you got your puppy, Rana. How did Rana come into your life?
Rana came into my life. I was working at a clinic, and they had a very close relationship with the local animal shelter. So the animal shelter would often bring in dogs, and unfortunately they would often bring in dogs to be euthanized. So that was probably most often the case when we saw the shelter employees. But at this particular time, the shelter employee came in, who I knew, I knew her fairly well, and she mm-hmm. came in carrying a puppy. And I looked at this puppy and I thought, oh my gosh, this puppy is the cutest thing I've ever seen. And then I had to go see, I was seeing appointments. So she was going to have the other doctor look at the puppy who'd been hit by a car and had a broken toe, two broken toes. And my next appointment didn't come. So I went out back and I said, I'll look at the puppy. And as soon as I touched the puppy, it was over. I just knew. And I saw so many puppies in my career. And but this one just, I had even picked up a puppy that was a stray on the side of the road, and I was tempted to keep it. But you know, this puppy, it was like this amazing instant connection that I knew that this puppy had to come home with me, that we were connected.
Tell me what Rana was like. Rana was a special one for sure.
She was a special one for sure. She was so cute. And I just remember when I got my, this was when pictures were developed at the, you know, you had to drop them off and pick them up.
Right.
You know, I dropped off the first roll of film and I got the pictures back and I thought, you know, that her cuteness just doesn't come through in the pictures. She's so cute. And it was just so funny. She got in trouble all the time. She was very different from Trudy, my first dog. And Trudy was a shepherd mix, and she was mostly shepherd, and she was very loyal and very obedient, and she liked to sort of order and routine. And Rana was just all over the place. She would just, Trudy would swim. I lived on a lake, and Trudy would swim and just come right back, and she would fetch the tennis ball, and Rana would just take off. And if she saw ducks, that was it. She would swim as far as, she would just swim after the ducks. I'd be jumping up and down on the dock yelling for her, and she would just be chasing the ducks until they flew away. And then she would turn around and finally come home.
And you had a scary escape once, right?
Very scary escape, and she was still a puppy then, and she
Oh.
got out of the yard, and it was sort of a, there was something funky with the fence, and she was able to wiggle through, and suddenly she was gone, and I had no idea where she was. And finally, after I was driving around in a complete panic, thinking there's train tracks nearby, I live on a main road. She was never off leash in the road, or you know, near the front of the house or anything. And it turned out, and I got a call from the dog officer that someone at the hospital 2 miles away had found a dog, and he didn't have a description. And I just started driving there because by then I had stopped running around the neighborhood, and I was in my car looking for her. And I got there, and one of the valets had found a dog. And I pull in and I park my car and I put the hazard lights on and I go running up this hill to the valets, who are looking at me like, who's this crazy lady? And I said, does someone find a dog? And they said, yeah. Someone, one of the guys found a dog and he put it in his truck and he's out getting a car. And I said, what did the dog look like? And he said, she had, the dog had two different color eyes. And I said, that's it, that's her. Because she had a light blue eye and a dark brown eye. And like a husky, I think she had some husky in her. And huskies, I didn't know that when I first got her, but I found out since then that they are known to be escape
I've
artists.
heard the
Have you? Yeah,
Yes.
yeah. So that was her, and she did not have a scratch on her, and she had crossed a divided highway,
Oh, my
hopefully
goodness.
not causing an accident. So then I ended up sending all the valets pizza. I sent them a, you know, a bunch of pizzas with a card that said, my puppy would have been road pizza if you hadn't saved her. I was very grateful.
That's a wonderful resolution to that story. And Rana, the reason she's featured so prominently in this book is because her story was too short. And I mean, she taught you a lot, I think, both as a vet and an owner. So tell me about how her cancer diagnosis challenged you in different ways.
Oh, it was so awful. She was only four, and I felt like it was this incredible life-changing event for me when she got diagnosed with cancer at the age of four. It really felt like my world had been turned upside down, and that nothing was right with the world. And I had a very hard time wrapping my mind around it. She had a very poor diagnosis. She had an MRI and they said, we can't do surgery. It was in her mouth. And they said, so she was going to have like part of her mouth removed, which is a horrific surgery to think about your dog having. But then they said, we can't do it because it's on the floor of the nasal cavity. And we don't want to do such a dramatic surgery, only have it to have it come back.
Right.
So then I had just learned acupuncture. So then I called all my teachers and I started home cooking for her, which ended up being really helpful for me as well as her, because it was such a helpless feeling to be told that she had cancer and that nothing could be done. And she was given a prognosis of only 3 months. And she ended up living for 18 months with a fantastic quality of life. Like, her quality of life didn't diminish at all, which was just amazing. So her tumor grew. So her mouth looked enormous. She looked like a little manatee, but she chased her tail and ran around and chased squirrels and got into trouble and still was very much herself, which was really quite amazing, because people would look at her and say, "Oh, what's wrong with your dog?" And when she was first diagnosed, I thought, "Oh my goodness, she's going to look so funny as this thing grows." And then as it grew, it didn't bother me. I mean, I didn't like looking at it, but other than being forced to look at it, her looking different didn't bother me, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. What you described in the book that you both learned and started practicing with traditional Chinese veterinary medicine was so fascinating. I knew nothing about this. You've learned a great deal. You've taken courses and you've helped as a TA. Tell me a little bit about some of the techniques and approaches to nutrition that are kind of under the TCVM umbrella.
It's very interesting about nutrition, especially. And one of the things is that, you know, sort of eating towards the seasons. And I live in New England, and we eat very differently in the winter when you might want beef stew or something cooked really well. Mm-hmm. And then in the summer, you might want fish and raw vegetables, and we feed our animals the same all year round. Mm-hmm. And the thought that food could have an effect, sort of food as medicine, that's one aspect of it, but also feeding her quote unquote real food instead of kibble, I think was very important. And I like to say to people when I'm talking to them about whether they're interested in home cooking or maybe getting, you know, some canned food into the diet and not just kibble, I'll say, well, you know, just imagine you went to your doctor and you had just gotten diagnosed with some chronic, you know, health condition. And your doctor said, well, what's your diet like? And you said, well, I eat a really good brand of fortified cereal, and that's all I eat. That your doctor would probably say, well, you know, maybe that's not the best way to get your nutrition. And I know that a lot of my clients, a lot of people home cook and are sort of afraid to fess up when they come to the vet because they know their dog should be getting dog food. And the problem is they can run into deficiencies. And so, you know, there's not enough calcium in a lot of these diets. There's certain, you know, minerals and vitamins. But fortunately, there are a couple companies now that will sell you supplements and you use their recipe. And that way you can home cook without worrying that your animal is going to get a deficiency.
What about doctors that treat people, veterinarians treat pets? There used to be some kind of division between those two fields. Are they working together now?
I really wish they would work together more, but there's a new approach called One Health. Some people would say it's a sort of an ancient approach, but it's now has a name and a website and people to talk about the One Health approach. And what One Health is it looks at the planet and people and animals as all unified, and the health of one, the health of the environment affects the others and vice versa. So it's a very important way to look at things. And especially when you look at COVID-19, you think, you know, these things are definitely interrelated. And there are more things. Like, there was just something on the news about dogs with cancer, and that they were using dogs to test a certain drug, and that people were taking, and that people, and this particular cancer with dogs was a very good model for people. So the more that kind of thing, you know, and that helps the dogs too. It's not mm-hmm. just, you know, if you do a clinical trial on dogs, but you're, you know, ultimately thinking you're going to use this on people, it certainly can help those dogs too. So there's some things that are very, very similar in dogs and people. And some people are surprised that, say, dogs and cats get diabetes. Mm-hmm. Some people are surprised to learn that. So it's the physiology is a lot more similar than it is different.
What's the one thing that you want, animal lovers, pet owners, but also just kind of all humans to take away from this book?
I guess the main thing and the thing that was in my mind and my heart for writing was that I want people not to feel guilty and not to feel like they've failed their animals, especially after their animals have gone. Because even I think a lot of people kind of look back after their animal has died and think, well, if only I had noticed this sooner or seen that sooner. And I've felt that myself with my own animals. I've thought that. But then I've sort of been able to pull myself out of that. And one of the things I think is, my animal wouldn't want me to think that. They wouldn't want me to be beating myself up about missing something.
My guest this hour was Dr. Karen Fine, Associate Veterinarian at Central Animal Hospital in Leominster, Massachusetts. Her book is called The Other Family Doctor. A veterinarian explores what animals can teach us about love, life, and mortality. Dr. Fine, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks so much for listening and have a great day.